My name is Noor Afshan.
And my name's Brad. And we're looking at film two of The Scar.
The opening scene to the film with the woman in the red dress. This scene was written right from the start. It was always there. It was quite a key scene. But I find it quite interesting how it was actually the very last scene that we actually shot in early January, actually, of this year.
Yeah, and it was always an idea that we had that in film two, our female protagonist would be the voiceover. And so we had to think quite a lot about, of course, what she would say, how long she would speak, whether we would intertwine her with the men speaking in the car, how much would be personal content to her backstory, which as viewers we don't know about yet, and at what point in our idea would her voiceover start to shift to start to talk about spaces outside of the car to some extent.
I mean, in some ways, film two actually feels and looks very much like film one, you know, so the actual look of the film, I think it definitely desired slightly to have a slightly more difference between the two visually in the films. I'm happy with the way they've come out. This film we did actually shoot in a studio and it is back projection. And I love that it's a bit more claustrophobic in terms of just the space. We feel less of actually being like on an actual car journey, but actually we're more in a vacuum. And I think Yenge's voice, but Yenge's character was always about the transformation of this in this space, the space of the car, the ecosystem. So this is where she really does start to take control. Really, that's the word. Yeah, she starts to take control of the atmosphere, the ecosystem, and eventually the car.
I mean, it's an interesting thought, just looking at this now just hearing what Noor was just saying. I think one of the things in terms of film structure I find interesting in film two is that in a way, our protagonist is ahead of us, our protagonist being Yenge, the female character. And as an audience, it's a growing realization that we're catching up on her narrative. And it's sort of written that way, you know, so we start to become far less interested in the male stories. Even though we give Rhys the main male story, we kind of cut away from it. It's a sort of sense you get of starting to tune out their frequency. And the building idea that there's another much greater subtext which is about to sort of slowly be revealed. And of course, as the female character subtext starts to come through, the male characters are starting to find that things are slipping.
I've got favourite scenes in this film. I mean, of course, I love the whole film, but the scenes that I really stick out for me is I love the scene with the resistant dead, the voices of the resistant dead, when that comes in, because that's also part of film two, is Yenge's shape-shifting and her consciousness is raising. She's basically, as I said, she's taking control, but she's also in dialogue. She's also aware of this other force that is starting to make itself present in the film, which lays the seeds for the third film.
Well, I think one of the challenges we also had with this was, I think obviously when you shoot a feature film, you don't shoot in the chronology of the story necessarily. Some great directors do decide to do that, but we were also having to shoot not just in the chronology of film two, but we were shooting all three films at the same time, so to speak. So everything had to be extremely tight on our shot structures so that everyone could locate themselves as to where they were, how they could handle things, and the degrees of freedom around that. I'm just watching now as Rhys buries these feet. There's a few recurring themes through the film. One of them is around shoes and around feet, and just watching as he smashes down . So the red dress scene has just popped up, and it was really a challenging scene, I think. I'm just reflecting on the idea that we shot it last, because I think we still, until the end, were just trying to decide, who did it belong to? Is it a real person? Is it the sister of Yenge? Is it inside? Is it sort of a psychological inside space? And just thinking about where performance sits in these films. So you sort of have this way that the actors, the four main protagonists, are kind of like being stretched, and their performances are becoming more surreal, like talking on Rhys talking into a shoe, which he thinks is a telephone. And then you have these other kinds of performances which are starting to erupt through and threaten in some ways to take over. And in film two, it was always a little bit trickier to think about, well, where does she rest? I think in the end, I'm quite happy how we resolved it, although I leave that open to the viewer to decide.
In terms of working with the actor, I mean, casting is, I think, in a sense, the reason why the red dress was conceived like from the beginning but ended up being the very last scene that was shot was because it's like it was actually about casting, not just casting the actor, but like, as Brad was saying, like casting where this very kind of critical, it's a small role, but it has such a kind of big bridge or linking across all of the films, really. And the actor, Claire, who we got to work with, we actually started working together. We did a read-through of the script, which was quite early on in the process, and we read through with four actors, actually all women, because we had a long discussion at one point about whether all of the characters would actually be women playing men. And Claire was one of the actors. So the read-through was really a process to help us write, to hear the words in space, really, rather than just like words on a page, you know, scene one, script, you know. And Claire is an actor, but she's also like a kind of performer that works very physically and works also with circus. So the relationship of being able to tell a story through your body and to embody something, to embody all of the complexity of, say, Yenge's character, but to actually perform that through what it means to bind yourself, to be bound by the patriarchy, but also to self be implicated, to self implicate yourself in this binding. So her performance is really quite simple, but it's for me, I always find it so powerful. The image of nailing yourself to this tree, and then this kind of the tension of being held, like, is the tree supporting you, or is she being, you know, held in the dress? What's the, you know, does the dress wear her, or is she wearing the dress? All these things, which are the real subtle things of how power and body and gender can be articulated. And then we ended up, of course, shooting most of this film in the long nights of August, but this was then shot in January, so this freezing cold, you know. So again, it's very hard to see or to feel that in the image, but I think the conditions of shooting and working with actors and collaborating to make these images, so much has gone in to make one of these images.
actually now, which are an area of the film I think of as the hinge, a sort of, although it's a three structured work, three clear chapters, it has got a kind of middle hinge where something shifts. And it's this scene with a tunnel where, first of all, it starts with Yenge on her own in the car. There's almost like a moment of like a breath where she's without them. And then it cuts to a roadway. And then it suddenly takes you into an area that Nord talked about earlier, of this sort of cycle of disappeared names. And she's in a tunnel with these men. I always feel they feel quite separate, the men, from each other. That's sort of how we shot it and structured it. That was an idea there, with this metronome happening. And I always get this, we always cut this scene long enough that it feels like you're going down the rabbit hole, you're going deeper into something. And we wrote it in such a way that as you sort of finally pass deeper into this, as she again calls towards the idea of wanting to, it's stuffy, or can you open a window, and refers to her breath, you come into the three Rises together in the car, each occupying the seats around her.
But if we're still on this scene, which I called, it is the Resistant Dead scene, and the names that are being called out, that they're sort of coming from the radio, but it's a transmission, it's a frequency, that no matter how much R tries to sort of tune it out, he can't, you know, because the agency of the Resistant Dead cannot be, you know, tuned out. But for us, it was also really important that when we're speaking about or wanting to try to sort of speak in a very everyday, accessible way of thinking about these deep structural, violent structures, that the names of the disappeared also spanned lots of different kind of positions, places, and contexts. So, you know, we've got there Mark Duggan, you know, so to be structurally removed and from society, from your family, by, you know, institutional racism, to names of people that have been disappeared from the southeast of Turkey, that, you know, so there's a lot of thought that's gone into the names, as in representing different positions of structural violence and those that have been disappeared from structural violence and different states.
So in the scene with the three Reeses in the car, this sort of height of the absurdity in a way, I wasn't ever sure we completely knew that this was going to work. I always felt quite confident, but I remember we wondered a few times. But actually, in the end, I like it a lot as this sort of, like, for me, this structuring moment in the piece where the final sort of male absurdity ends. And I always consider when you come out of the scene into something else, in fact, Yenge says it in her voiceover, you know, it's beginning to unravel, things are starting to, they can't hold all of this. So as he buries the feet, there's a cycle of doing so. He buries one, but in fact he sees another one, or the same one back. It doesn't stay under, it starts to come round.
Yeah, I mean, I think the scene has actually come out much better than, you know, I remember when we were talking about writing it, I remember just thinking, God, is it just going to be too much, you know, too much of this character? Because obviously, well, personally, that his character is definitely someone, is a man that I don't feel drawn to, you know. But he, the actor, Devrim, I mean, he plays this character so well, and it's been such a pleasure to work with him. And because again, these levels of how much do you want to bring a character like this to life? You know, I'm not talking about the original source. I'm talking about his character in the film. But he played it so well. So for me, I find that this scene now, it's got a lot of dark humour in it. I find it, like, it is, like, dark. It's like, well, you know, because this guy's really talking about, like, bashing people. And it, it is about death and disappearance, but it's also, it's like this whole kind of humor about, you know, you bash a feminist and out pops an anarchist, and then you get bash an anarchist, and then at the end out pops a Trotskyite, you know. But I think it's how it's delivered, you know, that whole idea of him just like wherever she, because it's Yenge's point of view that we take up as the viewer. So wherever she looks, she's kind of trapped by this multiplying Rhys and his bashing people.
And then just noticing the edit, you know, we return to her driving on her own, but now her narrative seems to expand it out of the car. You know, so even though we place her back in with the men, but we don't translate the men anymore. So she starts to talk in a different way about understanding her terrors. She starts to think about a break, and she doesn't specify yet what that is, but you can start to feel. And at that point, we bring back the woman with the red dress. And I don't know, there's a sort of like interesting discussion Nora and I had for quite a long time about resistance and what kind of resistance, and whether there's body knowledge and whether, or where knowledge exists in the body and in the mind. And this moment between the narrative of Yenge and the woman in the red dress, you can see us just slightly moving around that issue in a sort of visual way, or that's at least how I think about it.
I just want to talk more about the actual shoot. It's the first time I've actually worked in this way. It's the first time I've really worked in such a narrative way, storytelling, you know, the depth of the script. Brad talked about how structured in a way the like just the shooting script and you know, it was a big crew. I can't remember, there's probably about 30 people, you know, on set. So there was just a lot to hold down. But we were working nights. And so it was a bit of a joke to myself, but I ended up feeling a bit like a cine vampire, because we'd go out at 6 o'clock in the evening and, you know, you start off, there's all the trucks, the lighting, the rigging, you've got to set things up, you have something to eat. You become like a family so quickly. And then with that's all the dynamics that you have with family. So there's funny jokes and there's all sorts of things that are going on. And then you start getting into the work. And then we worked through the night until like sun up, which was, and then it was about 7 in the morning. But we were like literally like at every point we were like, okay, we've got to drop that shot. No, we need to keep that shot. No, it was like beautifully intense. But we ended up, I ended up becoming like this machine where, you know, I slept during the day but went out and was trying to produce these images at night in car parks in Dagenham and Croydon and, well, actually the woods in Croydon, but in Dagenham and Barking and Dagenham. So I have lots of incredible memories of actually physically the shoot.